Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insiders Capital. Today, we're digging into private markets and alternatives at a moment when the opportunity set is clearly evolving. Joining me is Ash Lawrence, head of AGF Capital Partners, to discuss insights from AGF Capital Partners, the annual 2026 outlook. In this report, Ash highlights five themes shaping private equity and private credit and alternatives, including how AI, private credit dynamics, private equity deal flow, defense and security, and retail investor access are reshaping capital allocation, and what all of this means for investors navigating a more complex, opportunity-rich private markets landscape.
This is Insiders Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Ash, welcome. It is terrific to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Pierre. Great to be here.
Ash, we're off to a whopper of a start to 2026. I mean, never a dull moment, right?
Yeah, it feels like we're well into the year, and I believe we're doing this on January 22nd. So it's only been 3 weeks.
3 weeks into 2026, and we're, you know, again, dealing with a new volley of U.S. self-inflicted geopolitical and domestic drama, Venezuela, Greenland, credit card rate caps.
Yeah.
Now, how are you separating the signal from the noise? I mean, I imagine it must be hard to put together a thematic framework or outline at any point in time these days.
Yeah, I think the way you really have to approach this is just recognize there's always, at least today, there's always going to be a bogey out there. Largely that bogey is the White House, U.S. policy, some factor related to that. If you try and predict what will happen on that front, it's near impossible. You'll consistently be wrong. So really the way to approach it is to just recognize that bogey's out there, but not try and predict it. And look at all the other factors and fundamentals and how they are reacting today. I think the reality is you just have to accept that it might not pan out tomorrow. And that's always been the case with forecasts. I think it just feels a little more, there's a little more emphasis on that fact today than perhaps in prior times.
Yeah, I mean, it's evolving, right? That's the operative word.
Yeah, I think that's right. Right? Like, yeah. Again, no one's writing an outlook for 2026 in November or December of last year and trying to factor in what might happen with Greenland. Like, it's just impossible to do. It's impossible to predict. It ratchets up so fast that there is no like real indications about how intense it's going to get on some of these factors. So the answer is you just can't predict that kind of stuff, and you have to sort of do your forecast and your thought planning for the year, knowing that it's sort of hanging out there.
Let's get into the annual for 2026. Which you just recently released. In your outlook, in the annual, you highlight that AI-related investment activity isn't confined to public markets and introduces new thematic concentration risks. How do you see private market investors effectively balancing exposure to AI-driven opportunities with true diversification across their portfolios this year in 2026?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting dynamic in the markets that investors will have to navigate. And I can't honestly think of another time where there was a innovation like AI where it impacts basically everything, right? Every business you're investing in has some potential for AI to change the way that they operate. And so it is pervasive everywhere. But I think people will think about this, especially allocators will think about this in two different ways. So one is top level thematic. And if you think about a lot of larger pools of capital taking on this total portfolio approach, or total portfolio management, where they are making sure to, and I'll simplify it to some degree, but look at exposures across their full portfolio. I think one of the benefits to doing that today is to understand across everything you invest in, how exposed are you to AI? So as an example, if you are investing in venture, my guess is probably at least your recent investments are going to be very exposed to AI. You also might have your infrastructure team or maybe real estate team playing heavily in the data center space these days.
Right.
And what's the connection from a risk perspective between those two things? So I think you'll see that at one level. And then the second level, and I'll use that same example, is as with every innovation, you never really know who the winners and losers are. And at some point over time, those big brand names that we know of at the beginning of the use or development of the innovation are not the same names that sort of dominated 5 or 10 years later. So there's two ways to play it, right? People will make their bets on who is going to be a winner and to make sure you're not overly concentrated on that side. The second way they will do it is to basically play in the infrastructure of AI. So whether in 5 years from now it's OpenAI or whether it's Gemini with Google, whoever the winner is, if you're playing on the infrastructure side, the so-called sort of pipes and plants that right. are going to benefit and drive a lot of the behind-the-scenes aspects of AI, you may not mind who the winner is at the end of the day because they're still going to need those pipes and infrastructure. So I think they're going to look at all those levels and try and make sure they're balanced across them. And then there is a third, which I think is very difficult and maybe even not necessary to think about in that theme. But, you know, every company is going to have an AI aspect to it at some point in the future, assuming this trend and the revenue generation of AI is what it is and the efficiencies of AI actually come to fruition. It'll impact every business they're investing in, public or private, for that matter. And to understand if you're investing where or at levels where if AI doesn't live up to its expectations, would you have still made that investment at that level? Right. That's sort of the right. third aspect of it. I don't think that many people to date in non-technology businesses are placing big bets on efficiencies or huge revenue growth because of AI. I think it is probably occurring more in the technology and software side of things or directly in the AI space. But I don't think we're quite at the stage, you know, in industrials where people are making large bets on the hope that AI is going to change the nature of the business or the operations of the business.
You've got the platforms, you've got the chips, you've got the data centers, and around it all, you've got the electricity generation concern, power plants, natural gas, coal. I mean, there's so many angles. It's a secular shift that's happening across the entire business ecosystem, whatever business you're in. There's potential for AI to be involved at every layer as a developing theme. You can see where investors are going to look across their entire portfolio to see, you know, where they're exposed.
Yeah, and they shouldn't lose sight of some of the risks at the upper level, the whole theme level, right? And you mentioned power generation, right? Certainly in North America, there are concerns that power generation will be the bottleneck around AI. And so how long is it actually going to take and will the power generation and distribution systems in the US and Canada actually be able to deliver enough power such that that arc of growth and use and thus revenue generation can actually occur on a timeline that makes sense for these investments is a big question. And that impacts the whole system if that doesn't occur. So there are very specific risks at a thematic level as well. And I think to some degree, a lot of people are still not entirely sure what the economic benefits to companies are going to be from this. There's still a lot of experimentation. I think everyone agrees at some point it gets there. But when really matters if you're investing billions and billions of dollars today?
Massive potential, a lot of unknowns.
So let's move on to the next category. You know, in the private credit space, there's a shift occurring toward mid and lower mid-market private credit opportunities, particularly outside of traditional sponsor-backed lending. What structural or market catalysts do you believe are most responsible for unlocking this segment? How should investors think about risk versus return in this tier?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of structural things occurring here. So the first is in what I'll just generally call the large cap space, which is really where most of the growth, most of the capital that's been raised, most of the deployment has occurred over the last, let's just call it 5 to 6 years. That space has an awful lot of capital looking at deals. As we all know, and we'll get to this, private equity has slowed down. A lot of those funds were raised for sponsor-backed transactions to finance sponsor-backed transactions. And you've also seen the return of the banks that they sort of pulled back a little bit after the regional banking crisis and then came back writ large, wanting to get their market share back. And more importantly, also recognize that private financing was playing a bigger role and will likely continue to play a bigger role. And so are now actually playing in the private debt space as well as the traditional bank lending space. A lot of them are doing it with private markets partners, but nonetheless, they're playing in that space. So it's pretty competitive. What we have seen in that space is that has obviously impacted, as it always does in the lending markets, when there's a lot of capital to lend, things like covenants and pricing start to get impacted. And I will just generically say it starts to become more of a commoditized profile of investment, right? Now, if you sort of compare that to maybe mid-market, maybe even more so in the lower mid-market, right, or the bottom end of mid-market, what you see is a few things. One, a much larger opportunity set. There's just way more companies globally or in North America that fit in the mid-market and lower mid-market. So it's not like sort of a billion-dollar deal. There's only so many in a year. And people really need to put that capital out. But you can have a lot of proprietary deal flow in the mid-market and lower mid-market. You can have a lot of non-sponsor backed deals. So you like can diversify yourself in that market as well. We're experiencing this with some of our strategies. You can have bilaterally negotiated loans. And when I say that, I mean, you're not competing. It's not an advisor or an investment banker working on behalf of a company getting term sheets from 5 different lending opportunities. You can still find through proprietary deal flow where you are the one, because of a relationship or otherwise, the one lender at the table negotiating a deal. So that all has advantages from risk, return, covenant perspective. I think the other reason we're seeing some capital shift or some more interest, at least in the mid-market and the lower mid-market, is one of the things that I think a lot of people experienced over the last few years when interest rates went up and transactions really slowed down in the private equity market. Well, that has flow-through effects if you're so heavily focused on sponsor-backed lending. And what happened was with large cap or very large deals, there is just less options in terms of monetizing the underlying company and thus repaying the financing. Whereas in mid-market and lower mid-market, you just have way more opportunity. The pool of buyers is a lot bigger. You can consolidate, you can have consolidators at that level. Whereas if you're the biggest company in the globe in a certain industry, like there is no one to consolidate you. So you basically have a pool of very large buyers or an IPO. And when the IPO market was shut down and you're looking at a small pool of buyers in a market that wasn't very transactable, your options are really, really tight. And we have heard this from some allocators where they just like the flexibility or the additional optionality of how to get repaid
or the event that triggers a repayment that exists in the mid-market and mid-market. So like I think about those two factors, and those are what I would call some market dynamics or structural aspects that would drive this.
Interesting. Very interesting. I mean, it seems to be, you know, especially relevant in Canada and, you know, where, you know, mid-sized, you know, entrepreneurs, mid-sized firms, you know, are having too difficult a time getting financing, getting credit from banks, and they're not big enough to get credit from some of these global players, some of these large global private credit firms. And so if you can, you know, sort of meet in the middle, the opportunity set is vast.
I think that's right.
So what happened with private equity deal flow? Let's talk about that. For you point out how there's been a logjam in private equity deal activity that you see easing this year, easing as of 2026. What are the from your perspective, Ash? What factors, including you know macro policy or capital availability, are most pivotal in driving a sustained increase in deal flow going forward?
Yeah. Maybe the first thing I'll say, a little tongue in cheek, is the industry, including myself, has not been great at predicting when this logjam will start to ease over the last couple of years. I think in the last forecast we did last year, we felt the same way. It was starting to loosen up, and we did start to see transactions. And then Liberation Day happened, and sort of over the course of the year, the first half of the year, it stalled.
Right.
And then we did
So that was the main driver of that, was the indecision factor.
To a large degree, yeah. It became very hard to value businesses in that, say, quarter after Liberation Day in April, because you just didn't know what the profile of the cash flows of that business would be because of tariffs or a lot of businesses. But then what we saw, you know, maybe starting in August and definitely sort of continuing at a, you know, not a huge trend and up and to the right, but certainly a trend over the last quarter, was an increase in IPO activity for sure, and an increase in M&A activity. Now, I'm going to say M&A writ large, so not just private equity M&A,
right,
but sort of all types of M&A. And so that has, again, led, when you combine that with rates came down a bit more over the course of the year. I think expectations are they will come down a little more this year, although inflation's picking up. So we'll see how that works, at least in the U.S. We saw in Canada they came down last year as well. So there are a bunch of fundamental trends. The economy in the U.S. is still strong, I think. Canada, because of some of the impacts of policy in the U.S., is on a little worse footing than the U.S. is, but still holding up. And unemployment's getting a bit tough in Canada, but we're still holding up. So you combine all those things, and we start to see the same green shoots that we saw last year. And again, I think sitting here today, we would say that should continue. But if I look at last year, if there is like a big possibility that one of those bogeys shows up and sort of stalls it again. But if we assume that yeah. doesn't happen, we see this year really starting to loosen up on the transaction side. And I say that with a couple of things. I'm going to set the bogey aside and say, at least in the U.S., there is expectations of a rate cut. And I think even if it's just one, I think that has a huge impact. Two, I think we're reaching the point in the private equity world where this has been going on for a period of time where it's starting to become not sustainable. And the outcome of it becoming not sustainable, or maybe I'll step back, the managers really do need to start generating some monetizations and some distributions. They've been tapping NAV loans and things like that over the last year, but it's getting to the point where things really need to transact. What that really translates to is, and maybe this is on the seller side, which is what I predict, you'll see any remaining gap in pricing between sellers and buyers start to shrink. Again, assuming everything
stays relatively stable from the geopolitical side of the world, you'll see sellers really adjusting their expectations on values of companies. And this is important for two reasons. One, if that happens, transactions will pick up, which is good. But it'll also allow the whole private equity world to reset a bit from what I think, if you look through portfolios, is still a pretty big hangover from 2021, first half of 22, maybe late 2020, which I think people were paying peak pricing on the private side for a lot of businesses. Right. That has not really been dealt with yet from a portfolio perspective. And I think, you know, this is the same in public markets as well. Every once in a while, you get to a point where it feels like a little correction is going to be a healthy thing for the market. And as we've just been like stuck with this logjam over the last few years, I think it really is a time for a reset to really get the private equity world going again. But it will require sellers on the asset manager side to start to look at their portfolios and maybe be a little more realistic about what they can actually move some of these assets at.
Right. I mean, there is, if you look at the liquidity and capital flow in the market, it's very strong. I can't help thinking, like, you know, if last year things got held up because of all the uncertainty that occurred, it feels to me like, if I'm just reflecting on, you know, that sentiment, it feels like by the end of the year, we started to feel like a sigh of relief because, you know, we got used to the temperature of the water. A lot of the uncertainty that's being caused by White House bluster, for example, ends up being a negotiating tactic.
Yeah, right? That is, I think that would throw, but over 25, what I would say, and I'll use tariffs because that was really the large impact,
yeah,
over 25, right? Like what we also saw over the course of the year was, okay, it's not going to be 25%. It is going to be 10 or 15, and maybe there's exclusions. And to be like perfectly frank, 10 or 15% tariffs is still not good. But to some degree, at least give me stability. And then I know how to operate in a 10 to 15% tariff world. What caused those problems was uncertainty.
So, you know, flip-flopping.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it looks like to some degree it's continuing. I mean, we have, like for Canada, we have a very, relatively speaking, a generous tariff deal with, you know, that seems to be standing right now. Like most trade with the U.S. under CUSMA is still largely exempt, except it's that 15% portion, which is, you know, auto, steel, aluminum, that is still sort of up to negotiation.
Coming soon.
And yeah, and you know, by the looks of it, it's like, you know, if as long as we have, you know, something we know and understand in place, why should we upset the apple cart and try to renegotiate a whole new deal? You know, Carney's sentiment is, we're not going to make a deal unless it's good, you know, and in the meantime, the deal we have, you know, the status quo is what we have, the current status quo, and you know, we're actually sort of living through it. And so as long as it doesn't get worse, everything's fine. All that really matters is can we make it better, or can we, you know, do away with it? Like, you know, the midterms are coming. And the thing that always, you know, that I find befuddling, since we're on the topic of tariffs, is, you know, this is amounts to inflation or tax on American consumption of our goods. You know, why even, it's still bewildering, you know, like it's a negotiating tactic to, you know, to a large extent, in most cases, but, you know, it just looks like the whole point of the Greenland debacle was to get Europe to fall in line.
Or, yeah, look, I mean, both what may or may not happen with upcoming trade negotiations on the North American deal or Greenland, those are those bogeys where, like,
by no means do I think I'm in a position to sort of forecast what might happen or even include some aspect of a forecast in our sort of outlook for market sectors. I think you just have to hold that bogey is out there and make your forecast based on some assumption that there will be a level of rationality somewhere in the system on the outcome of these things.
The interesting, I think one of the interesting conversations that I listened to this week in one of the news shows, I can't remember which one, but it was the idea that to use your word, the bogeys are getting bigger because we've gotten used to the previous bogeys.
For sure.
Anyway, I want to talk about your fourth theme, which is defense and security. And it's sort of a nice segue from what we've been talking about. But with all that's happening geopolitically, you highlight defense and security as significant, as a significant emerging investment theme alongside AI. The two seem to go, you know, increasingly nicely, very well together. Driven by just the fact that we have rising geopolitical tensions and evolving procurement models. How do you see private markets allocating capital to defense-related opportunities in 2026? What are the unique risks and return dynamics that investors should be thinking about in this sector?
Yeah, so this is a sector in the private markets that we're quite excited about, and we do have a platform that does this, so we're sort of making these comments from a position of knowledge. So we do think we're going to see increasing flows from investors into defense and security related investments, both in the near term and the long term, quite frankly. So obviously geopolitical reality, so I'll sort of set that to the side. I think there's a number of other factors at play here, and technology, AI, yes, it's part of it, but I would say more broadly, technology has really disrupted how governments are able to achieve their objectives in defense under the old system with the primes. And this is a huge factor here, is as technology becomes a bigger input or innovation becomes a bigger input into products or services in the defense and national security sector, it will require a change in the procurement structure such that they can't get everything from a skill set or speed or flexibility perspective from the large primes anymore. This has opened up a huge sector, quite frankly, to the venture capital world. Right. And this is all to do with dual use technologies, expanding markets and all that kind of trend that we've seen over the time. So technology has changed the game in one facet. I think geopolitical realities have changed the game in another facet. I think the third thing, which again is not rocket science and everyone realizes this, is the funding needed to do some of these improvements or achieve some of these objectives on the defense side is astronomical. And as we all know, in certain countries in the world, including ours, that has been an underinvested from a national perspective, and has been underinvested in for a long time. And so it is simply not something the government is set up to do without the help of the private sector, private markets in this case. And you put all those three things together, and there's just a massive opportunity in the near term, because a lot of those government objectives, whether Canada, US, Europe, they are trying to achieve those in very short order.
Carney's speech at Davos was quite revealing on that front. I mean, speaking to, you know, Canada's need to up its defense spending and also its commitment to help with NATO.
Mm-hmm. Clearly that capital has to flow into some channel that actually achieves those objectives. Yeah.
That's really a tailwind to what we're talking about here.
That's 100% right. Yeah. The government is going to have to provide whether it's policies or maybe more general, let's say just the general environment for private capital to want to participate in this. They will have to create that environment, whether that's procurement or other sort of policies around it. That said, the one thing I will say is, like, it's not just governments that maybe have underinvested in this over time. It's also the private markets have underinvested in this over time. And that also means there's not a lot of expertise out there. There are some asset management firms that have been doing this and they have the expertise. But this is one of those sectors where investors really need to look at the platform that they're going to invest through, the asset manager or vehicle they're going to invest through, and ensure that the skill sets or knowledge are there for this particular sector. It's not the simplest of sectors. It comes with risks that maybe don't exist in other sectors. Obvious risks, given that you're investing in defense, and you need a manager that has thought through those risks, that can risk manage them, that has approaches that ensure your capital isn't going to places that it shouldn't be going. So this is one of those new areas that will grow, but certainly in the near term, people should be very focused, or investors and allocators should be very focused on who the manager is and what their skill set and experience in this sector is.
Last year was really a wake-up call from post-World War II thinking, which was that, you know, we're neighbors of the U.S. We took it all for granted, and maybe a large, you know, maybe the large reason why we haven't as a country budgeted adequately or at all for defense was because we have been, up until last year, very solid neighbors and friends of the United States.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but when the rhetoric points to Canada, we've had to become, at least, you know, to consider the idea of becoming more nationalistic in our view. You know, more as an island, more to think of ourselves and to make decisions for, you know, what does our defense look like?
And that was a big part of the investment opportunity, right? Because it's not just us are thinking that way, right? Like, if a lot of European companies are thinking, or countries are thinking that way, like, this is opening up broader opportunities. We are to some degree focused on Canada, but we have a global aspiration around this from a deployment perspective.
I think the other thing that just to latch on to something you said about governments and their spending, I think the other thing that is pushing this dynamic and trend is the definition of defense and national security is not what it used to be. So when you think of a defense-focused fund, for example, like, that could include also everything from cybersecurity,
right,
to cloud-based solutions that are built on the fundamental aspect of sovereignty. Like, those are all things now that would fall into defense and national security investing. That didn't exist as part of that sector not too long ago. And it is very different than what the government is used to doing, which is, let's negotiate a contract to build 5 submarines. Right? That's not the same thing as, you know, let's build a piece of software using AI that, from a cybersecurity perspective, can help us secure our national infrastructure, as an example. But they all fall into this category now.
Something very, you know, as ubiquitous as TikTok has been at the center of this argument as well, right? Which is that, you know, if everybody, you know, globally is using TikTok when it was strictly controlled by China, you know, there was all that national security talk about the Chinese government spying on the rest of the world through, you know, through its access to TikTok, whether or not that's even happening. But the likelihood is that, yes, you know, that's...
Yeah, what that really does for investors and managers is... like, the realization that the playing field for deployment and investment is still much larger in this category than it used to be, which is one of the reasons that folks are trending towards it, which is, oh, it used to be very narrow in terms of what this meant. But now that it's so broad, that helps with diversification. It helps with risk. It helps with just deploying larger amounts of capital as well.
What are the key misunderstandings you see among retail investors today, and how should asset managers better support investor literacy in these products?
Yeah, so I think the biggest and most obvious for me, and I think the retail market's participation in private markets has been underway and has been growing. And thus, we have reached a point where we're starting to uncover certain aspects of how products are designed, about the structure and investments, where we're finding some complications or challenges that need to be overcome. The most obvious of which we're experiencing heavily in Canada right now, is this mismatch, which we all sort of acknowledge, but this mismatch of the tenure and hold periods of underlying investments and business plans and the extent of time it takes to implement business plans in the private markets on your underlying assets versus the desire and the structures that have been put in place to try and satisfy investor demands for liquidity.
Right.
Like, it's that mismatch that always existed, but we've kind of reached a part of the cycle where we have, you know, a certain concentration of retail investors that happen to match a part of the cycle. And I'll use private equity as the example, where there's a lot of liquidity in the system and performance has been muted. And you put those two things together, and we end up where we are today in Canada, and it's happened on the credit side in Canada, the real estate side in Canada, where we had a lot of funds suspending redemptions because that liquidity mismatch just reached untenable levels. The positive of this is that we're seeing is it's triggering the conversation finally around this mismatch and how to solve it. And that's doing two things. Like, I just alluded to one, which is, you know, attempts to adjust structures to solve for this mismatch, right? To yes, we can put redemption features in place, but if they don't work because of this mismatch, why, like, what's the point of them? And let's be very honest with each other about that. But what it's also doing is just leading to a general education to those retail investors that are investing in private markets about what this mismatch is, forcing them to spend a little more time understanding the underlying assets and how those transactions and business plans and value creation works, and getting them a little more educated to put this in a part of their portfolio where they can be less concerned about sort of near-term or short-term liquidity. I think what this will sort of come to over the next 12 to 36 months is two things. One, perhaps not all of the retail market should be investing in these types of structures, right? Like, there is going to be a little bit of a pullback for those folks that just can't manage that type of liquidity or lack of liquidity. And I think that's healthy, because I think you need a little bit of a reset, take away those investors that have been investing because of FOMO, fear of missing out, and have those investors that have actually thought it through from a portfolio construction perspective. So I think we may see a little slowdown in growth, and then we'll see it pick up again, but on much better foundations. And two, I think you'll see the current suspensions, or the results of the current suspensions, being managers coming up with different ways to deal with the mismatch in terms of vehicle structures that perhaps are more realistic. I think there's going to have to be give and take on both sides in terms of managers coming up with better cash management or fund management approaches to ensure some level of liquidity, but also investors realizing the level of liquidity is not going to be 100%. It just doesn't exist when you're investing in private equity or private credit, where they have real timelines to the investments. So I think it's a benefit. It's happened sort of this early in the cycle as it relates to retail investors and private markets. And I think we'll be better off for it in 24 months, especially in Canada, and be able to sort of resume the growth in terms of retail's participation in these type of markets. But again, like I said, on a much better foundation.
Yeah. I it's an evolution, right? I mean, it requires, you know, finding ways to strike the right balance.
Correct.
Between, you know, between the mismatch and the actual, you know, making it work, finding structures that work.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we sort of reached that, again, that very good stage in the evolution in Canada, where we'll start to put more realistic expectations and structures in place.
Yeah, I think it's incumbent on, it's incumbent on advisors and allocators to make sure that their clients understand how different structures work, how different kinds of, you know, investments have different liquidity frames that you need to pay attention to. And you guys have done a lot of successful work on that front as well, in terms of structuring products that meet with those demands.
We have, and we have structures that we know we need to adjust over the longer term to make sure they work as well.
Ash, any closing remarks? I know you got to run.
Yeah, no, I think, look, 2026 will be exciting for so many different reasons. But I do think as we go through the year, after, in certain sectors of private markets, what has been a challenging year or two, I think of private equity, I think of real estate. I think, again, short of some of those larger exciting moments, we are in a good position in some of those sectors to see 2026 come out positive for sure. But we are living in a world of unknowns and where norms no longer apply. So let's all hang on for the ride, I think.
I have to say, in parting, I'm very curious about the defense theme.
Yes. Yeah, we'll see how that plays out over the year, but we're quite excited about it here.
I bet.
Yeah.
Ash, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight, sharing your take on private markets for 2026.
Always a pleasure, Pierre. Thank you very much for having me.